ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There was a chook who was left something like £10 million in a will. She was called Jiju, but she was rich, so maybe posh, like Jiju. Anyway, does that mean I can leave my car to my cat or my daddo to my dog? What the Duck is presenting Nature's Most Wanted, the intersection of animals and the law. You know, pigs being tried for murder or ducks getting speeding tickets. What the Duck on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr.
Identification, poetry reading by A.D. Hope, end of ident.
Country places. I glean them from signposts in these country places. Weird names, some beautiful, more that make me laugh. Driving to fat lamb sales or to picnic races, I pass their worshippers of the golden calf, and in the dust of their Cadillacs, a latter-day Habakkuk rises in me to preach comic sermons of doom, crying, woe unto Tokenwall, Teddy Waddy, Tulibuck, and wicked Wollum Burrowang, your hour has come. But when the four horsemen ride their final muster, and my sinful country sinks in the fiery rain, one name shall survive the doom and the disaster that fell on the foolish cities of the plain. Like the three holy children, or the salamander, one place shall sing and flourish in the fire. It is Sweetwater Creek at Mullingandra, and there at the last day I shall retire. When Numbugger shrieks to Burrumbuttock, the curse of Sodom comes upon us all. When Tumbarumba calls for spade and mattock, and they bury hell and hay in Booligal, when the wrath of God is loosed upon Gilgandra, and Galagambone burns red against the west, to Sweetwater Creek at Mullingandra I shall rise and flee away and be at rest.
He had a comb-over, wore a tweed jacket, smoked and smoked and smoked, and spoke in that old-fashioned, educated Australian drawl. Apparently gentle, actually ferocious. To this day, A.D. Hope haunts Australian writing, not always happily. Patrick White called him the great Panjandrum of Canberra. Now, what the poet feared in life has happened 26 years after his death, a biography. Susan Lever, who taught literature for many years at the University of New South Wales, knew him in Canberra when she was a student and then as a young academic. She writes, I've never doubted that A.D. Hope deserved a full biography, and as time passed with none appearing, I felt it necessary to take up the task to honour our friendship. Susan, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you.
Do you know what a panjandrum is?
Oh, I had to look it up last night because my family were all asking me. I always thought it was a false god or false prophet.
Me too.
But apparently it just means somebody who's authoritarian but, you know, overreaching.
No. I looked it up this morning.
Oh, did you?
Yes. Right. A massive rocket-propelled, explosive-laden wheel designed by the British Admiralty in World War II to destroy German concrete defences. Intended to cross beaches at 60 miles per hour, it was highly unstable, uncontrollable, and notoriously failed during tests.
Well, that's even better than the secondary one. There is a secondary meaning, which is closer to what you and I thought it meant.
Yes, yes. Exactly. But as a judgment of A.D. Hope, fair?
Well, I, of course, don't think he failed. I think that the poems, they hold up, in my view. Not all of them. I mean, there are poems that he wrote that I hate, but I think there are at least 50 that are fantastically good or so interesting that you can't dismiss them.
Is a mark of great poetry what you get from time to time in Hope, a sense that a line that every word of a line is inevitable.
Yes, yes. Even though he's rhyming, and, you know, most of his poetry rhymes, not all of it. There's a few late poems that don't. that are in free verse of a kind. But, you know, because he's rhyming, that he's got to work really hard to find the right word. But it does seem inevitable. So that's the amazing achievement of it.
Every time I came across one of Hope's rules of poetry as I read your biography, I noted it down. Now, this is my list, Susan. What he didn't like in poetry. Okay, what he would not have in poetry. No politics, no ideology, no sentimentality, no nationalism, no religion, no moralizing, no experimentation, particularly no free verse, no messages, no confessions. Now, Susan, what's left after
and
that?
And no personal life.
And no personal life, yes. Now, what's left after that for a poet?
Well, I've come to the conclusion that what he did was he thought poetry was his way of thinking. He didn't think poets should just sit around writing about the gum trees and the scenery. So what he's doing, I think, is thinking through poetry. And what his poetry is working through is analogies all the time. So sometimes they're satirical analogies, like the brides being created by machines and so on, and you follow through the narrative or the analogy that way. But that was the kind of philosophical mode that he was using. And when he wanted to think about something, I think he wrote a poem or struggled with a poem to try and get it right. So what is he left with? He is left with tradition. And what he saw the role of the poet was to revitalise tradition. And of course, his whole professional life was reading the tradition of English poetry. So he knew it backwards, really. And so that's what he was grappling with. It wasn't about him, but it really, of course, as he said himself, all poetry is affected by the personality of the poet.
My list from the book of what he wanted from poetry, yes, to renew tradition, irony, yes. Detachment, craftsmanship.
Absolutely craftsmanship, yes.
To write the truth of male sexual imagination.
Well, that's my addition.
Yes.
He never said that. But I feel, because I've reread these poems like The Damnation of Byron, which is in some ways a very funny poem, but also pretty confronting, you think, well, why is this man writing this? And it's, I mean, some of his earlier poems, you know, are about the problem of masturbation, really. That, you know, why is it that any woman's body, you know, it doesn't matter who, can actually incite lust? And he's trying to work that out, you know. And, you know, it isn't just because it's smutty or obscene. It's because he's actually worrying about his own kind of reactions and trying to understand them psychologically, I think.
But yet write impersonally.
Yes, that's right. And trying to avoid any identification. And that's why I felt that in the end the biography mattered, because it gave context to the poetry and made you see how he might be working something out through it. Because at this point in his life, you know, he might have just got married, or he'd just come back from England and been a failure in Oxford, you know, and that the poetry is being written out of this feeling of failure, really. Which is a personal feeling, but it's not. It's presented as a version of Ulysses or something.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Susan Lever, whose biography of A.D. Hope has just been published. Susan, Presbyterian,
yes.
A Presbyterian boy, son of a Presbyterian minister in remote Presbyterian outposts.
Yes.
What does that do to a poet?
Well, it's very clear that his childhood in Tasmania, in Kirklands, which is, I went to visit Kirklands, it's still not a town, it's just a church and a manse sitting in the countryside.
But outside. The pines are dying?
Well, they've been cut down. They were dangerous. They were so old, they were dangerous. So, you know, sorry, Alec, but your favourite pines are gone.
But have you noticed, we're of a certain age, that those banks of pines that were part of the Australian landscape,
yes.
such a familiar part of the Australian landscape, they've gone.
Yes, because I think they became dangerous.
Yeah, they've
yes.
died and not been replanted. Anyway, yeah. The pines have gone, there we are.
There
in
we
Kirkland.
Are. So here's this little boy, age 3, ends up in Kirklands, and that's where his childhood is spent. In a manse with this it's a beautiful landscape, rolling hills, a river, you know, it's beautiful. But he's isolated. He's taught by his mother. They don't go to school, the children, because it's too far to travel. So, but what he's got is his father's library, his parents' library, which is full of poetry, and he's free to read it all, some of it far in advance of the age he should have. And he's even said he tried to write a novel when he was about 12. An improving novel. I mean, yeah, the lovely joke about writing when he was 8, giving his mother a birthday present of a poem with 52 stanzas, each with a moral for the week, to improve his mother's moral life.
What a wretched child.
And that's very Presbyterian, I suppose. And it's coming out of the world he's living in, which is this family world of Presbyterian, reading the Bible every day, the church is in sight all day, you know.
Years later, Leonie Cramer said that he wrote Presbyterian hymns. True?
Yeah. He was very hurt by that. Very hurt by that book by Leonie, because she'd been a great friend of his for so long. And, you know, she announced that there was no need for new collected poems because there was nothing in his latest book that was worth, you know, hanging on to.
She could be as cruel as him.
Well, and to Patrick White too, right?
Yes. Indeed.
So he was quite hurt by that, but because he really didn't feel that he was limited to Presbyterian hymns. But, of course, the fact is he loved Presbyterian hymns. He sang them in the car when he was driving around the countryside. You know, they were one of the things he held on to from Presbyterian life. But, yes, he felt really quite hurt by that, yes.
He lost his faith when he was at university.
Yes.
But kept that fact from his father for decades.
Yes, yes.
Was he a coward in those sorts of things? Was he too scared to face big issues like that?
I think he had that thing about not wanting to offend anybody ever. I mean, that's one of the wonderful contradictions, you know. He wrote these savage reviews of people, really hurtful. I mean, the one of Norma Davis where, you know, you should get the pixies out of your hair and stop writing this sentimental rubbish. Poor Norma Davis was dying of cancer at the time. Then, you know, then she was dead and this is her dying review, you know. And so he did this sort of thing, but then, of course, felt mortified when he found this out about Norma Davis. He didn't feel mortified at all about Patrick White or the Jiggy Warabacks or...
The fabulous dismissing of the Tree of Man.
Yes.
Illiterate verbal sludge. Yeah.
It's memorable. Everybody remembers
that.
Well,
Patrick White remembered it all his life.
Yes, but everyone does. And of course, the thing is that got reprinted, that review. Like he didn't sort of say, well, that's gone. Mm. He put it into a collection of, you know, the Native Companions that he brought out in the 70s. So everybody got to reread it.
Now, look, I'm going to exert some very strong narrative control in this conversation.
Yes, I think you should.
And it's been my own fault that we've wandered ahead because what I wanted to ask you about was this young man gets to Sydney University and quite by chance there arrives at Sydney University a figure called John Anderson.
Yes.
Now, explain Anderson, explain what he mattered, how he mattered to Hope.
Yes. So Anderson was a Scotsman, quite an exciting teacher and, you know, charismatic figure, really. And he landed at Sydney University to teach philosophy. And he also had a copy of James Joyce's Ulysses in his pocket and began promoting Ulysses to the students. It wasn't banned at that point. It wasn't banned till 1929. He set up the Literary Society and a free thought society. And Anderson was an atheist, and he believed that there should be no people should think freely without the confines of religion, politics, good taste, and they shouldn't consider those things in their thinking. Well, Hope said this was the most exciting teacher he had, was Anderson. And he got a first-class honours in philosophy as well as in English. And so he says that he kept Anderson's rules in mind for the rest of his life, really, that you had to accept science. You couldn't pretend science hadn't found things out about us.
Science was true.
Yes, that's right. So you had to accept those things. You couldn't sentimentalise them. You had to actually face up to that, which is one of the reasons why religion had to be kind of cast aside, because, you know, that was a problematic thing. He didn't agree with Anderson's belief in realism in literature. Anderson believed that James Joyce was a realist, and Alec, of course, he was a poet. He wasn't, you know, he didn't write realism. And he thought that the great thing about James Joyce was that he was a philosopher and a thinker, and he had conceptual notions. And that is why I think Alec's own poetry is poetry of someone who's using poetry to think. You know, it's his way of understanding concepts. He saw himself as a philosopher. But I did notice in the ANU files there was a note saying, you know, Alec Hope philosophizes more than anyone, but actually J.A. Passmore is a better philosopher.
Now, there you go, jumping ahead again.
Yes, sorry.
This has got to stop. He went to Oxford and there failed spectacularly.
Yes.
That failure marked him for life?
I think so. I think it marked the way he wrote reviews, you know, his very high-minded notion of what good poetry and good writing should be. He believed, because he'd been praised and given prizes in Australia and regarded as, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread by everyone around him, so he went to Oxford and failed in this spectacular way, let everyone down. His parents had, you know, weren't rich and they had to support him for part of that time. So when he came back to it, he had the idea then that the standards were lower in Australia.
Yes.
Because he was regarded as terrific in Australia, but when he got to Oxford, he wasn't. So therefore, his position then on Australian literature was often that the standards were too low, and that's why he had to be a tough critic, because, you know, he had to lift Australians' game and they had to understand the world was bigger than them.
But was there a sense that when he returned from Oxford, having only got a third,
yes,
that he would play the role of someone who had in fact succeeded in Oxford? I get this sense from your book that he played roles through his life, and that one of those roles was to be a lofty Oxford-educated critic who could look down on Australian work and who could write something as intriguing but horrible as his poem Australia, which he wrote, a couple of years after returning?
Yes, well, he started it, yes.
Started it, most of it written then.
Yeah, yes.
And in which he said that Australia was a land without songs, architecture or history. Now, that's just bunkum, nasty bunkum.
Yes. And, it's this dry country, et cetera. It's about his emotional... Yeah, that's where it's personal, isn't it? It's his emotional response to coming back to Australia, having failed in the big world and trying to, I think the first stanzas are wonderful myself. And I wish, they're really savage. And then the end of it, he's trying to say, well, maybe, you know, from the desert the prophets could come. Maybe Australia might just be able to produce something.
The stanzas added years later.
About 7 or 8 years later.
Yep.
Yes. But I don't... He wasn't really pretentious as a person, David, he did feel very much like he told me in the 80s about this terrible failure. You know, he didn't hide it from anyone because he just felt it personally as, you know, I'm not really what you think I am sort of thing. But you're right about him playing roles. He notes sometimes that, you know, there's one person who's the professor and another person who's the one in meetings and the other one who's the poet and so on. Yes.
Mm, mm. But the practical impact of getting such a poor degree, essentially a failure from Oxford,
yes,
is that when he returned to Australia, he couldn't get the kind of job he wanted.
That's
there was
right.
nearly a decade
yes.
where he's wandering around in teachers' colleges, teaching essentially psychology, which he'd done a bit of in his
yes.
philosophy degree, that sort of kept him alive.
Yes.
But it was not a time where he set out to prove himself by becoming a literary academic.
No, no.
And there's a sense in his whole life he was never really a literary academic.
Never. No. I mean...
He was never going to be a conventional literary academic.
He didn't want to. He didn't believe in research. right? Research in literature was a waste of time. You know, well, you can do it. You can burrow your way through the Mitchell Library if you like that sort of thing, but it's not the main game. Criticism is the main game. Reading is the main game of literature.
But there's another game that matters for him, which is language.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And teaching himself other languages. He learned at university or by, you know, teaching himself all the precursor languages to English.
Yes.
He knew how the English language worked in its most intimate machinery.
Yes, and that's why at Oxford he thought he was going to become a philologist. He did Icelandic, Gothic, Anglo-Saxon, German,
name it.
No wonder he failed. I mean, how could you remember all that? and of course, at Oxford at the time, they weren't allowed to read anything that was published after 1830. So there was no question that they ever read anything contemporary.
The death of Wordsworth was the cut-off point, wasn't
something
it?
Something like that, yeah. Yes.
Whereas at Cambridge, they were teaching contemporary literature.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, he was at Oxford.
Yeah.
He was at Oxford and comes back to Australia and is, you know, moving around the place with these kind of odd jobs, really.
Yes, yes.
But writing.
Writing, yes.
Yes.
In the 30s, absolutely. So he had these poems he was writing. Not publishing, though. Not publishing all through the 30s.
Mm. Published as a student, didn't publish in the 30s.
Yes.
At the end of the 30s, he married. Tell us about his wife.
Penelope.
Penelope. And tell us, if you can, what that woman meant to him.
Well, he met Penelope in Canberra. She wrote a book about her childhood in Papua New Guinea. Her father had established a rubber plantation with his in-laws, and she'd lived there, you know, with her father until she was about 20. And then, so, you know, she said she felt she'd been left on the shelf. You know, she moved to Canberra because her uncle was the Senate Secretary of the Senate, I can't remember what the title is now, probably Usher
worked
of
in
something.
Parliament.
Yeah. And so she worked as a, she did a typing course, worked as a public servant, but she obviously went to the newly founded Canberra Rep, where she was obviously acting. And I think Alec was too, quite frankly, or he went there because there was nothing else to do.
Because he'd been a bit of an amateur actor, hadn't he?
He had,
university.
Yes, yes.
This is why I see him playing roles the whole time. Yes,
yes,
so they
exactly.
Meet.
Yes, so they meet and they marry quite quickly, but he's already nearly 30, sorry, at this stage when they met. And so the thing is, Penelope worked. You know, she worked after they got married. Then she had to look after the children. They had three children fairly quickly, and when they went to Canberra, she worked as a secretary in one of the departments. And so she was always there. She was always sensible, and rather a wry person, and very quite witty as well as Alec. So that people were drawn to her quite a lot. She was quiet, but she understood. She had that kind of wry opinion of her husband.
Terrible expression, but was she a soulmate?
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, they had the same interest in culture. They were both interested in reading and theatre and music. But I really didn't know her, so I don't like to push too hard on that. But, you know, various people have different views of her that they've told me. But nearly everybody loved her, and he did too. It was a long marriage.
It lasted.
She stuck it out. But I don't think people had that many choices in the past.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Susan Lever about A.D. Hope and her biography of Hope. The war started, but there was no sort of sense in Hope that he was, rushing off to fight.
No, absolutely. He didn't like war in any way. He had a pretty strong memory of how awful the First World War had been. And that wasn't just because his father went. That was because when he went to England in the 20s, there were still signs of the damage that the First World War had caused to all sorts of people. And so the Second World War he wasn't at all enthusiastic about. And was frightened he was going to be called up, actually.
But wasn't.
Wasn't. He was too old, I think.
And he was also in what was called a reserve occupation.
He was, yes. I think only one of the teachers at the Sydney Teachers College was called up of that lot, yes.
Strange war work, in a way, but it was in the war that he became a broadcaster.
Yes, yes, he did.
On this ABC.
He did. He actually started before the war. As early as 1938, he was doing things for the Department of Education. After he started the Teachers College, he was doing introductions to Shakespeare's plays and that sort of thing. But then he got the regular gig on the Children's Hour, which had the Argonauts Club, people may remember.
Still going in your day and mine?
Yes, well.
It lasted until 1969.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was...
Anthony Inkwell.
Talking about...
poetry. And he did it every Thursday, I think 5 o'clock Thursdays, he'd go into the studio and do 15 minutes of Anthony Inkwell talks to children about poetry. He began, after it got going, children would send him their poems and he would very kindly read them and choose those that were good and encourage them.
He was Anthony Inkwell. Geoffrey Smart, that great painter, was Phidias talking about painting, and there was Mr. Melody Man, Lindley
yes.
Evans,
yes.
talking about music. And these, they were talking to kids about the sort of central music of the culture, painting, writing. It was an extraordinary time.
Yes.
It was an extraordinary time. But he then was a broadcaster almost for the rest of his life, wasn't he?
Yes, and all through the 50s he had a program. It was every Sunday morning, Books Worth Reading it had been called, and he would be on once a month talking about three or four books. People like Vance Palmer were on the other morning. So every Sunday there was a book show basically, but different people would present. But he did that all through the 50s. So he really had a broadcasting career that began in 1938, went right through to the 60s really.
I want to jump back now
yes,
because
yes.
to explain where he stood in the world of Australian literature
yes.
to the 1940s, back to the 1940s.
Yes, do.
And to the Ern Malley hoax.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because he was great friends with James Macaulay, and we have a bit of interview, ABC interview by John Thompson
yes.
From the 1960s, talking about James Macaulay's role in his life and this group of friends.
You've been closely associated and, as a matter of fact, readers are apt to group you with James Macaulay and Harold Stewart.
Mm.
I imagine that when you were all close together, you probably did criticise each other's work at that time, didn't you?
Oh, yes. I think we met first when I was at the Sydney Teachers College and Macaulay was still a student there. And he, in fact, did something like the artist at an earlier period. I remember his taking me to a pub one afternoon and talking about poetry to me and then taking me home and reading my poems and going into them pretty thoroughly and saying, now look here, this is absolute rubbish and you're wasting your time on this line, I think, and giving me reasons for it. And then saying, now this is the thing you ought to do. You carve that duck, he said to me, you carve that duck. Once again, I took this pretty seriously, and Macaulay is still one of the people I send poems to see what he thinks about him.
This was a case of the student instructing the master.
I suppose it was, yes.
do you three of you are associated very much as Auden Spender and McNeice were in England in the 30s. Do you regard yourselves as a distinct group among the Australian writers?
I shouldn't think so, not now. At that time we did sort of huddle together for warmth because it was a period when, Angry Penguins, Max Harris's magazine was coming out. Poetry tended to be experimental and daring and, we thought, formless. And our verse, when it was published, was apt to be criticised as academic. I suppose we did huddle together then.
Now, explain the Ern Malley hoax and Hope's role in it.
Can I first say that what he just said is wrong? Macaulay.
Biographers do this kind of thing. Yes,
yeah.
Susan?
Macaulay was not a student of his at the Sydney Teachers College at the time. He didn't go to the Teachers College till 1941, and he lived with Alec at the time. So that was not their meeting. And Macaulay denied that he would ever use the term, that's a duck. He said, don't tell me I would have ever used that expression. He thinks maybe Harold Stewart was the person who took Alec to the pub and went through it. But anyway, that's just denied that. So,
Susan, I didn't bring you on radio to destroy a wonderful anecdote, but you have.
Yes,
I suppose it's
I
your
know.
Responsibility.
Alec would have worked on those anecdotes over the years, and his version of Ern Malley, he got a much more important role as the time went on. People always asked him in interviews about it, so he kind of felt he had to elaborate his role.
But he
role.
Was just a spectator, wasn't he?
He at the time, he told Clem Christensen he was on the shore watching them play Max Harris. They were fishing for Max Harris and he was just sitting on the bank watching and enjoying it.
Ermalee was the creation of a fictional character,
yes,
where two wonderful poets, yes, wrote sort of, what would you call it?
That was supposed to be phony poetry.
But the problem was that it was so much of it was so good.
Exactly.
And it was designed to lure Harris into applauding these phonies, which he did.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yes, and it, the worst thing, I think, was that it ended up in the courts because it was seen, some of the poetry was for some reason read as obscene by, you know, the police. So that was the worst part of it for Alec, because that meant censorship was looking at poetry, which it hadn't done up to then. But I think it's important that he was in Sydney. They were in Melbourne. They were writing this together. They were both in the army in Melbourne writing this poetry. Alec was in Sydney. And he says in that interview that he was writing his own hoax poems and he found that they weren't good enough. There is that question always. You know, if they're good enough to be accepted by Max Harris, then they're probably not really hoaxes.
Exactly. That's what makes it still such a wonderful, wonderful thing to think about. But
yes,
rolling back on.
Yes.
The big moment was when he went to Canberra.
Yes.
And he reached Canberra when? In 1940?
50.
1950.
51, I think.
51.
He was,
he was a professor at Canberra, then, which was then a college
of the Melbourne
University. Yes. Had not yet affiliated with ANU. So he is there in Canberra at the very early, in the very early 1950s. Tell us about that town then. What was it like to be a poet in Canberra in 1951?
Yes, it's because I grew up in Canberra, I was very amused to find that the Melbourne building, which if you know Canberra is Northbourne Avenue, right in the middle of Civic, that's where the University College was, upstairs in the Melbourne building, above the shops. And there was a fire then, about 53, I think.
Oh, burnt all his papers.
And then they moved them across to Childers Street where, again, people who are as old as me will remember Childers Street. They were these timber huts that had been built for workers to live in as they built Canberra. So it was very much, a downbeat kind of campus. And of course, there were only the few professors. There was, you know, Heinz Arndt and Manning Clark and Finn Crisp.
Remarkable men.
All of them. And Manning hadn't a publication record much either. You know, none of them had much behind them at that point. But they were all, they made ANU as the undergraduate part of ANU eventually by just keeping working at the things they were doing and being kind of stars in their field.
And if you were a star in your field and if you were a poet, you bumped into Bob Menzies.
Well, Bob Menzies had been a poet, you know, at various times in his life. Yes, he fancied himself as a person who read poetry and called Alec Keats.
And Hope, who, you know, 20 years before had arrived back home in Australia with this demeaning sense of what his country was, became a teacher of Australian writing.
Yes.
And a hugely important figure in the teaching of Australian writing.
Yes. He didn't, people dispute this about his role. He did the fight with the University of Melbourne. His friend Ian Maxwell was professor in Melbourne and didn't want a bar of teaching Australian literature. So the first year of it, it was always taught by Tom Inglis Moore originally. And so the first year was sort of an extra. And 90 people turned up. You know, there were only 30 enrolled students, but 90 people turned up for this course. So they knew that there was this popular interest. So Alec would have only done the introduction. And he didn't become a teacher of Australian literature. He stuck with Old English and all
but
the other
But as a critic,
things.
I suppose.
But at the same time, he's writing every month in the Sydney Morning Herald. He's writing a critical article on Australian writing. He's giving Commonwealth Literary Fund lectures around the country. He's promoting Australian writing in that way and sort of overseeing the fact that it's being taught as an undergraduate subject. It was always a bit of a poor relation, even at ANU. Probably still is.
Didn't he have a sort of rule that you came to Australian literature after you'd studied literature?
Yes, he had that terrible image of a doctor who'd only learnt about the knee or something and was going to take over the world. Yes, you had to have a firm grounding in English literature, preferably, and then you could move to Australian literature.
We're quite late in his life now and he still hasn't published a book of poetry.
Absolutely no, yes.
But that comes in 1955.
Yes.
Tell us about the book. Tell us about the response to the book.
Yes. So, I mean, he'd been rejected by MUP and he'd had the fire. He had to retrieve his poetry after the fire burnt everything.
But didn't he say something like he remembered the poetry? He didn't need the early drafts or something like that?
Oh, no. He said he had a memory like a sieve. Oh. And I think he did. But he wrote to his friends, you know, because he had sent them to Macaulay.
And got drafts back from
them.
And
they sent back the drafts. He was more upset that he lost his lecture notes, actually.
because they were hard work.
So he kind of had given up on the book because MUP sent back a really, you know, a rejection letter. But the word got round and his friends all sort of knew that this had happened. But really Roland Robinson was the one who wrote to Alec to say, you know, thanks for reviewing my latest book on the radio. Why haven't you got one? And within a week, Robinson's publisher had written to Alec to say, we're interested if you've got a book. That was Edwards and Shaw. But it still took something like 9 months before they brought it out, and they cut 4 or 5 poems out.
Again, for the fear of obscenity, including Imperial Adam.
Yes, but they also didn't publish Australia. So it wasn't just, you know, fear of sexual.
It wasn't just sex.
No, they said it was the standard of the poetry. Observation car was another one they didn't put in.
Oh, rubbish.
Yeah. So
complete rubbish.
What was their judgment doing? I mean, I'm
but
sorry.
But Susan, explain this to me.
Yeah.
Wandering Islands, when it appeared in 1955, was greeted with enormous applause.
Mixed.
Okay, but why does a book matter so much when so many of these poems had already been published?
Yes.
Tell me about this.
Well, they were published mainly in student magazines, so people wouldn't have been able to read them unless they were university students.
So the book reaches a new audience.
It reaches a new audience. It establishes a position. You know, the thing about the Wandering Islands when it first came out, he'd reviewed so many people so savagely that they all got, you know, they got their own back. You know, David Martin, you know, really said it was had nothing to say and it was just smuttiness and so on. Only his friends, you know, his friends gave it good reviews, but anyone who he'd savaged gave it a hard time. Douglas Stewart, I give credit to, who managed somehow to give it a reasonably fair review despite the fact that Alec had really savaged Douglas Stewart shortly before. The important thing was that when he went on study leave to America and Britain, he had a book in his hand and he could give it to people. People could read it. And so he found a British publisher through friends in Britain. So the really important thing for him was that Hamish Hamilton published poems in 61, or beginning of 61, and he also met Malcolm Cowley, who was the poetry editor of Viking Press in America. And when he saw it, he also took it on. And so suddenly he's an international poet.
And the critics in the United Kingdom and in the United States had not been savaged by him in earlier reviews. So they came to him without bloodlust.
Absolutely. What a good point. Yes. But also, can I say, it's a much, much better book than Wandering Islands. If you know, if you're looking for a book, well, the collected poems is what you should look for, I suppose, secondhand. But the it's got Australia in it. It's got Observation Car. It's got The Death of a Bird. It's got I think that's in the first one. But you know, there's a whole lot of really important poems in it that hadn't been in Wandering Islands.
And ladies and gentlemen, Susan's recommendations for the poems you must read will be up on our website. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Susan Lever, whose biography of A.D. Hope has just been published. How did he write? What kind of writer was he?
I'd have to say a very slow one. I mean, these poems take years. Certainly, The End of a Journey, which he's got at the front of all his collected as his first poem, he began in 1932 at least and didn't finish it till 1950 or later. You know, that just this slow, slow accretion. But he got faster, I think, as he got older.
He confesses to this, and we've got him confessing to John Thompson exactly this.
Your own work seems so fluent and easy that one wonders whether you write your poems quickly or do they take time to write slowly?
Oh, well, I have occasionally sat down and written a poem straight off. But on the whole, I'd say I compose very slowly and with a good deal of difficulty. And sometimes I come to a full stop and it may take me 2 or 3 years to get the poem finished.
So he didn't move fast. Of course, making things seem effortless can be huge work, can't it?
It can, yes. Interesting, after he met Faye Zwicky in 1975...
Explain who Faye is.
Faye Zwicky, at that stage, wasn't a published... didn't have a book. She was a poet and a critic, a really sharp person. If you ever met her, she's very sharp, just like Alec in being sharp and witty. He met her in Perth in 1975 and he read all her poetry and criticism. And then he got on the plane and wrote a poem to her on the plane back from Perth. That was, for me, the one improvisatory moment. Of course, it doesn't rhyme.
Ha! It's rhyme takes time. Hey,
it does.
What about that? Rhyme takes time.
Well, not for you, clearly.
No. You can see the look on her face, ladies and gentlemen. You would see that it was not completely approval. Now, there is throughout your book an acknowledgement that Hope was unfaithful to his wife, that he was many, many lovers, and that these were important for his work and important and a great difficulty for his life. But you are not able to detail much of this. Is that because you pulled back from it, or is it because you didn't have the information?
Well, yes, I think that's an ethical problem. I don't think you can say somebody had an affair with somebody unless both parties said they did and are happy about that. Alec did tell me about some affairs he'd had and named the names to me as he got older. But I know that behind the Planctus sonnets is a real affair.
Behind which?
The series of sonnets called the Planctus.
Yep. On the list, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, it is. It's a serious affair there. It's quite one of the most difficult to understand of his poems. Most of them are fairly clear. I think the greatest poem he wrote is the epistle, Edward Sackville to Venetia Digby, set in the 17th century, but it's clearly about a love affair that he has experienced. Nobody has ever come, you know, there's no writing or, you know, written admission of any of these.
But, Susan, there is a mountain of his papers in the National Library, is it?
There are, yes.
A mountain.
Yes.
And yet he culled carefully, did he not,
he
in
did.
Life?
I mean, I think I said he tore pages out of his notebook, but actually he cut them very carefully and neatly out of his notebook. So, you know.
But scissors.
Yes, but you know, there are still things in there that are about, he's saying, you know, I met somebody or other and I had a dream about this person and you know that that's probably an affair he had. And also, of course, he fell in love with women and the Glenn Tomasetti case, for example,
She was a...
Oh, Glenn Thomas said it was a folk singer he met in 1959 when he got back from overseas and he got her to come to Canberra to give a lecture, and they walked and talked and they wrote a lot of letters to each other. And it's, you know, these are letters of someone in love. You know, he's saying, all my thoughts are going to you except when I'm writing a poem. You know, you are the monologue is going to you in my head, which if anybody's been in love, they know this sort of experience. And she then married someone else and went off. So it never came to anything. They didn't have a physical relationship, and it's quite clear she wasn't up for that at all. But, of course, then she wrote a novel called Man of Letters about someone awfully like Alec.
Oh, writers, brutal. Brutal.
I thought it was cruel.
Oh, now look, at a certain point you were handed an envelope.
Yes.
What was it?
Oh, yes. I ordered everything I could. And
From the depths of the National Library.
And a lot of it, you know, it all came up. And among them was this envelope which was sealed. And it was the letters from Alec, between Alec and Penelope. And it had written in very big letters, "Do not open without permission." And it sat on my desk while I read all the other papers, and I looked at it and thought, what am I going to do? And in the end, I thought the risk was that the library would catch me trying to open it and ban me forever from reading the papers. And so I didn't. I did ask permission from the family, but I got a no. So I don't know what's in them, but perhaps that would be the secret for some future writer to go in and write the story of the marriage. I didn't want to write the story of the marriage. I wanted to write about how the poetry came to be and how it worked within not only Alec's life but Australian life, you know, the broader things that were happening in Australia. And to make the point that his poetry isn't sitting in a cloud somewhere above us, it was actually coming out of the life he was living.
Does it matter for the poetry he wrote that from what you've experienced with the envelope and the culling of the notebooks, that he was moved not to embarrass his wife?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And do you think that shaped the way he wrote? The kind of impersonal lover?
Yes, I think that, and you can see then, really after those cases in the 40s of Robert Close and indeed the O'Malley, Max Harris suffering under the O'Malley, where they were taken to court and charged with obscenity and so on. You can see that from then on he's beginning to look for mythological ways, mythological stories he can use, or stories from the 17th century, to disguise what's going on in his life. While an earlier poem called Invocation, in the end called Pygmalion, so that it would disguise what it was about. That's a poem about marriage, I'm quite sure. But he's not going to do that again.
Would he have been a better poet if he
would have been
wasn't doing that sort of thing?
He would have been more of the zeitgeist, I think. You know, he would have been part, like, you know, Macaulay wrote much more personal poems as he got older. He would have been more in keeping with what was happening elsewhere if he did that.
You're right that he outlived his reputation.
Yes, he did.
What does that mean?
Well, by the 1990s, he was still alive and he was still publishing poetry. I don't think he was still really writing it, but he certainly was in his 80s, early 80s, he was still writing poetry. And there was a kind of feeling that really he'd had his turn. Could he please go away?
His turn.
Yes. You know, oh my God, he's still alive. The others had all died, you know. Everybody predeceased him. Gwen Harwood, and these are younger than him.
They'd had their glowing eulogies.
And Kenneth Slessor, you know, presented his 100 poems and said, oh, that's it, I'm not writing anymore, and lived on, you know, without anybody ever complaining. But Alec just kept going, yeah.
What should we read? I mean, I'm somebody who read Hope ages ago.
Yes.
And when I reread him, I find there are lines there that have never left me. Oh, that's where that's from, you know.
Oh, yes. But
now there are going to be people who become curious about Hope because of your book. Half a dozen poems they should read.
Yes. The first thing I have to say is you're not going to be able to get hold of some of them. I do think the epistle, Edward Sackville to Venetia Digby, is the great poem. I also think Moschus Moschiferus, which you will be able to get hold of because it'll
be there. And which you will hear in a moment, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, I think it's a perfect poem, a perfect example of the craft and holding everything together. I have found The Coasts of Cerigo is one that appeals to me more the more I read it, which I passed over in earlier times. And unfortunately, I don't know that it's in every anthology, not in many anthologies. I mean, you'll find Australia everywhere you look.
Can we just keep that line for a moment? Can we just celebrate that line for a moment? You'll find Australia everywhere you look. Okay, sorry, Susan, let's go on. But surely Imperial Adam.
Imperial Adam is the other one you'll get hold of.
The Death of the Bird.
Look, most people say to me The Death of the Bird is their favourite poem of his. People who read poetry.
Yes.
You know, and it gets read at funerals, bits of it. You know, it's one of those classic poems that will be there forever, I think. Yes. I think, you know, the Mayan books is really worth reading. And The Return of Persephone is also brilliant in its way. I change what my favourites are sort of day by day as I look at them. But at the moment, they're the ones that I think. I'm trying to think. Inscription for a War is the other very popular.
Brutal, wonderful poem.
Six lines. Yes.
Yeah.
It's there.
Go back and tell them you killed us.
Yeah. Yeah, the old man's safe in your bed. We took your orders and are dead.
Shall we end?
I think
by listening to Hope himself reading Moschus Moschiferus.
Yes, that'll be interesting.
Okay.
Yes.
Moschus Moschiferus, a song for St. Cecilia's Day. In the high jungle where Assam meets Tibet, the small Kastura, most archaic of deer, were driven in herds to cram the hunter's net and slaughtered for the musk pods which they bear. But in those thickets of rhododendron and birch, the tiny creatures now grow hard to find. Fewer and fewer survive each year. The search employs new means, more exquisite and refined. The hunters now set out by two or three. Each carries a bow and one a slender flute. Deep in the forest, the archers choose a tree and climb. The piper squats against the root. And there they wait until all trace of man and rumour of his passage dies away. They melt into the leaves, and while they scan the glade below, their comrade starts to play. Through those vast listening woods, a tremulous skein of melody wavers delicate and shrill, now dancing and now pensive, now a rain of pure bright drops of sound, and now the still sad wailing of lament. From tune to tune it winds and modulates without a pause. The hunters hold their breath. The trance of noon grows tense. With its full power, the music draws a shadow from a juniper's darker shade. Bright-eyed, with quivering muzzle and pricked ear, a little musk deer slips into the glade, led by an ecstasy that conquers fear. A wild enchantment lures him step by step into its net of crystalline sound, until the leaves stir overhead, the bowstrings snap, and poisoned shafts bite sharp into the kill. Then, as the victim shudders, leaps and falls, the music soars to a delicious peak, and on its silvery piping calls fresh spoil for the rewards the hunters seek. But when the woods are emptied and the dust draws in, the men climb down and count their prey, cut out the little glands that hold the musk, and leave the carcasses to rot away. 100,000 or so are killed each year. Cause and effect are very simply linked. Rich scents demand the musk, and so the deer, its source, must soon, they say, become extinct. Divine Cecilia, there is no more to say. Of all who praise the power of music, few knew of these things. In honour of your day, accept this song I too have made for you.
What do you reckon?
I think it's wonderful. The description of the music, it's lovely. It's a beautiful thing.
It's brutal.
But it's got that, you know, the sharpness of the ending. And, you know, and it presents it to you without comment in a way. It just says, there's nothing more to say. This is what human beings are like.
Susan, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Susan Lever about her book, A.D. Hope, A Life, that has just been published by La Trobe. Thanks, as always, to the Late Night Live team, to producers Catherine Zengerer, Anne Arnold and Ali Benton, and our executive producer, Jack Schmidt. Until next time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.